The action takes place on John Brown's farm at Richfield, Ohio, in 1854, shortly after the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which gave the citizens of those two new states the right to decide by their votes whether those states would be free or slaves. A meeting has been called outside the Brown farmhouse to hear an abolitionist organizer. The meeting is called to order by Farmer Hickey, a neighbor of Brown.
Come closer, everybody. Now let's get a little order. Now there's Manny Buell, the banker's son. Be careful you don't step on his toes. His old man will pull your farm from right under your feet. We're going to have just one speaker today, Mr. August Bundy from Baltimore. He's got something right important to tell you, and I want you to listen. Now, Mr. Bundy.
Friends, ladies and gentlemen, I'm glad to see so many ladies out here today, because if the men have to make up their minds, the women better be right on the spot or else they ain't going to stay made up.
The woman rules the roost. That's right.
We have a serious problem before us, friends. But before I go any further, I want to do two things. First, I want to thank Mr. John Brown, a neighbor of yours, for letting us use his farm for this meeting. Second, I don't want to sail under false pretenses. I'm here in the interests of the Free Soil Party.
Hooray!
Free Soil Party. Kansas must be saved for freedom. And I'm here to tell you why. We've got two great sections in this country. The section that thrives on wage labor and the section that thrives on slave labor. These two sections are like oil and water. They can't mix. Further than that, in order to survive, each section must control the government and Congress in order to legislate those laws which benefit itself to the detriment of the other. And today, what do we find? We find that the South, the section of slave labor, has through chicanery and corruption won control of this government. This government is a government of slaveholders. There has been no legislation except for the benefit of slavery. The Supreme Court of the United States is owned by slaveholders and has been bought by their cash.
Hey, Bundy, you don't like this country. You can go back where you come from.
My friend, only the Red Indian has a right to say that.
Wait,
my friends. You Buell. You're opposed to the Free Soilers, eh?
Yeah.
Why?
Oh. Why? Because you're against the government. You try to stir up these mobs against liberty and the Constitution. You want to turn servants against their masters and have them burn down barns and crops and destroy private property. I was born and raised in Ohio, and I don't own no slaves.
And I understand you, my friend. A human being who happens to be black-skinned is property, and that worries you. Well, we want to confiscate that property, Mr. Buell, and we'll do it, by God!
You're anarchists. We'll run you out of town, that's what we'll do.
I warn you, citizens, if Kansas goes slave, we're one step nearer to being bought and sold like hogs.
Oh, fiddlestick, prove it.
Prove it? You want proof, eh? So here, listen to this. The Richmond Inquirer says the time will come when the northern states will have to introduce white slavery in order to compete with the South. I tell you, the South is insolent and grows like a weed. Cotton wears out the soil quicker than an eagle flies. They've got to get new land or they die. They plunged us into the Mexican War. Why? To take Texas and add it to their slave empire. And now they're drenching Kansas in blood in order to conquer new soil for King Cotton, and they do it in the name of the Constitution.
That's treason. Wait, let me speak.
Let him speak. I can answer him.
This man's an abolitionist. It's the same kind of talk that started two factories in the East. His kind of talk leads to anarchism and sedition. This man's a seditionist, an agitator bought by British gold. He don't deserve to be in this country, and he ought to be strung up. He ought to be shut down like a mad dog.
Keep his gun, friends. Keep his gun. We need it for Kansas. And we need men. We need men the way the crops need rain. Unless we pour 5,000 freemen into Kansas in less than 2 months, 5,000 who can vote, Kansas is lost.
Visit to the Soviet Union, I try to carry forward in America Mayakovsky's use of the mass chant in the speech and the experience of the people.
In the town of Braddock, Pennsylvania, where steel mills live like foul dragons, burning, devouring men and earth and sky, it is spring.
Now the spring has wandered in. A frightened child in the land of steel ogres, and Jan Klepek, the great grinning Bohemian, on his way to work at 6 a.m, sees buttons of bright grass hung with wild white blossom. And as he sweats half naked at his puddling trough, a fiend by the lake of brimstone, the plum trees soften his heart. The green grass memories return and soften his heart.
And he forgets to be as hard as steel, and remembers only his wife's breath, his baby's laughter, and the way men sing when they are drunk and happy.
He remembers cows and sheep and the grinning peasants, and the villages and fields of sunny Bohemia.
Listen to the mournful drums of a strange funeral. Listen to the story of a strange American funeral.
Wake up! Jan Klepek, the furnaces are roaring like tigers. The flames are flinging themselves at the high roof like mad yellow tigers at their cage. Wake up!
It is 10 o'clock and the next batch of mad flowing steel is to be poured into your puddling trough.
Wake up!
Flawed lever is cracking in one of those fiendish cauldrons.
Wake up!
And now the lever has cracked. The steel is raging and running down the floor like an escaped madman.
Wake up!
Oh, the dream is ended.
The steel has swallowed you forever.
Jan Klepek.
Listen to the mournful drums of a strange funeral.
Listen to the mournful drums of a strange funeral. Listen to the story of a strange American funeral. Now 3 tons of high steel hold at the heart the bones, flesh, nerves, the muscles, brains, and heart of Jan Klepek. They hold the memories of green grass and sheep, the plum trees, the baby laughter, and the sunny Bohemian villages.
And the directors of the steel mill present the great coffin of steel and man memories to the widow of Jan Klepek.
And on a great truck it is borne now to the great trench in the graveyard.
And Jan Klepek's widow and two friends ride in a carriage behind the block of steel that holds Jan Klepek.
And they weep behind the carriage blind and mourn the soft man who was slain by hard steel.
Listen to the mournful drums of a strange funeral.
Listen to the story of a strange American funeral.
Listen to the mournful
mournful drums of a strange funeral.
Now three thinkers are thinking strange thoughts in the graveyard.
Oh, I'll get drunk and I'll stay drunk forever. I'll never marry woman or father laughing children. I'll forget everything. I'll be nothing from now on. Life is a dirty joke like Jan's funeral.
One of the friends is thinking in the sweet-smelling graveyard as a derrick lowers the 3 tons of steel that hold Jan's Kleypas.
Listen to the drums of the strange American funeral. Listen to the mournful drums of a strange funeral.
I'll wash clothes. I'll scrub floors. I'll be a 50-cent whore, but my children will never work in the steel mill.
Young Kleypak's wife is thinking, as earth is shoveled over the great steel coffin, in the spring sunlight, in the soft April air.
Listen to the drums of a strange American funeral.
The other friend is thinking, the listener.
He who listens to the mournful drums of a strange funeral, who listens to the story of a strange American funeral.
I'll make myself hard as steel, harder. I'll come someday and make bullets of Jan's body and shoot them into a tyrant's heart.
He who listens to the mournful drums of the strange funeral, who listens
to the story of a strange American funeral,
listen to the mournful drums of a strange funeral. Listen to the story of a strange American funeral.
Listen to the mournful drums of a strange funeral.
Listen to the story of a strange American funeral.
Year after year I have seen the great proletarian dawn unfold over the world, revealing new human miracles. The self-exiled, self-contemplating author who rejects the people rejects reality and its wonders. Only in the real world, with its endless change and growth, can be found fresh and inspiring material for art. A national literature can be based only on truth and the people. The proletarian writer has an unshakable faith in the masses. What other creed can stem the tide of fascism and war?
Mike Gold, American Gorky, Walt Whitman of Hester and Delancey Street.
You are the Pied Piper of our youth, Mike. Our own voice crying among the Hoovervilles.
America, I cannot worship your money, God.
You came like Gorky from the tenements, pounding the city pavements with his javelin, shouting down the enemy from the housetop.
This monster whose heart is a Ford car, whose brain is a cheap Hollywood movie.
Like Whitman, you were our sweet singer of America.
I saw the sun walk over the Rocky Mountains. I saw the wheat fields blaze in the flames. I saw millions of American flowers and heard the bird song.
The echoing voices of Jan Kleypak and May Carty and John Brown in the hollow catacombs of Wall Street.
You are America's own, Michael.
An enduring part
of the flesh of America.
Tonight, we honor Mike Gold, a writer. As I see, a writer is a person who observes life, forms opinions, ideas, and feels the need to communicate those observations to other people, to share his ideas and opinions with the people. And he influences people, whether he so intends it or not, and to the degree that he influences people, he has a responsibility. There are, of course, a great many writers, all kinds of writers. Great ones, mediocre ones, good ones, bad ones. There are writers who have no love for or faith in people. The horde, they call them, or sometimes here and there refer to them as the masters. They have no faith in their abilities. And though talented, there are a lot of talented ones among them. They can present a fine work, draw a beautiful picture. They reflect life as in a mirror, cold. There are other writers who have a love for people, but have no faith in them. They have no faith in their ability. Those writers lack the understanding what it is that makes people as they are. And lacking that understanding, they look down on them. There are also, of course, the great giants of literature with a great compassion for people and understanding. The giants that created the masterpieces that influence people, spur them on, inspire them to study, to improve their life, to go on to always better life, to build, to study, to find out. Writers like Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Bernard Shaw, Mark Twain, and the great son of the people, Maxim Gorky. My goal is Kaul Maxim Gorky. He's our son of the people. He's bone of our bones, flesh of our flesh. He has a great love for people, and not only love, he has respect for them. He hurts with our hurts. He delights in our pleasures. He's hurt when we have failures. He rejoices when we have achievements. My goal is a writer who always looks for the why of the people's problems, the why of their troubles, the why of poverty, of discrimination, the why of the corroding fear, like a rust, that corroding fear of economic insecurity. And he not only looks for the why, he looks for the how. How to change, how to correct, how to improve, how to show a way to a better and always better life. And Mike found the how in the great social science, Marxism, a science, not a dogma, a science based on the all-inclusive study of life, of every aspect of life, based on study, based on research, and therefore based on facts. A science that points the way to the how to change, how to improve, how to show people a way to a life, a richer, better life. It is a social science. It is a theory, but not a cold theory conceived in an ivory tower separated from the people. It is a living study. It is a constantly changing and growing science. It is a science that has proven itself in the fact that over 900 million people have used it as a guide and are using it as a guide to build a great new life for them and for others. My goal always gives that sign, looks for that sign. My goal is not a snob. I don't think anybody, whatever anybody will ever say about Mike, they will never say that he's a snob. Mike is our own, he loves people. Any one of us can come up to Mike, argue with him, and disagree with him, and give him hell too once in a while, like in that recent controversy with the Mexican women having a lot of children. But above all, we love and respect Mike. Now, as I said, Mike is a writer. He doesn't write only books. like dances, is a play. He also rides a cow in our daily paper. That, pardon me, it's a wish to go back to the daily that we used to be in our weekly paper. He writes a cow once a week in our home people's work. And being a realist, he knows that this is the paper through which those who write in it point to the how. To the how to change, to improve, to correct. And it is the only paper, I think, all of you here will agree with me, that shows the working man's side, shows the poor man's side, shows the truth, principle. Mike believes in socialism. He believes in socialism so much that he was ready to give up a habit that some people call a pleasant one and most people call a very bad one. The story about that habit, Annette Rubinstein wrote. Once he was pointed out, he smoked. He pointed out to him that smoking is no good, it'll shorten his life. And that was way before we had all the facts about the bad effects of smoking. And Mike said that, well, so it'll shorten his life, so he'll live a few years less. But then he figured out that the few years less might be the very years that he might live under socialism in America. And that's not right. So he gave up smoking real fast. Now, as I said, Mike writes for our paper. And I'm sure that if we succeed in getting our paper back to the daily that I mentioned at the last hour, he will write daily, not just once. I hope you will, Mike. I know you will. But a paper doesn't function by itself. No matter how many devoted people work on it and for it, it needs money. And I thought of the best possible way that we can honor Mike tonight, show our love and respect for it, is to build our paper. And one way to build it is to help it with money. I mean, a real tangible way of showing our respect for Mike. And the one tangible way that I know of is the financial way.
I believe we'll dovetail in with the headlines on today's paper and tomorrow morning's paper. It's from Yoshito Tara Hirano, General Secretary, Japanese Peace Committee. Congratulations on your lifelong dedication to peace, freedom, and brotherhood of people. Now, this is a sentence out of a four-page letter from the Japanese Peace Committee, greetings to Mike Go. Sir Naruhiro Ko, President, National Peace Committee of Bulgaria, your noble efforts during the last four decades to foster understanding and friendship among nations is a great contribution to the world's peace movement. Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, many readers all over the world deeply appreciate Mike's warmth, his beauty and simplicity of language, his love of people, his enthusiasm for struggle, his understanding of youth, and his devotion to the cause of socialism. Jim Jackson, Mike Gold's pen is a flaming sword against tyranny, a trumpeting herald of the people's tomorrows. From D.N. Pitt, Queen's Council, Mike's wide choice of things to believe in, his disregard of the inconvenience and dangers into which noble beliefs are apt to bring some of us, endears him to me and to all of us. From the Soviet Union, Writers Union. We know Mike Goll as a staunch friend of the American workers and the workers of all countries. From W.E.B. Du Bois and Shirley Graham, we are glad to see how Mike has surmounted great difficulties and is still working steadily for the uplift of mankind. From Maria Ovestanik
Kova, editor-in-chief of Soviet women's magazines, your writings never fail to bring response in the hearts of ordinary working men and women. We wish you ever greater success in your far from easy labors. We will now have two songs by like Mike Gold more than at the present. Mao Tung, Chairman, Chinese Writers Association, we firmly believe that your mighty pen will continue to serve the progressive cause of mankind and strengthening of friendship between the Chinese people and American peoples against the common enemy of our two people. Our George Braff will read, I forget, you'll announce your own reading.
These people here. This is a hard job. I've been taking 15 minutes. For about a month, I've been trying to write 10 words in the telegram or something, a letter to Mike. I can't do it. So since I've given only 15, cut out the last, eh? I want all that time for myself. They say mine is the non-literary approach to this subject. What can you say about the guy for whom you are the official barber?
Yes, he recommends my barbering. I cut his hair. A few years ago, he sent one of his sons, then the older son, who is just about to step out into the direction of a trade, out to us in San Francisco. And even though he's no longer a minor, I still insist that I'm Nikki's labor guardian, okay? And I hope I shall always be. But I certainly mine is the non-literary approach to this subject, and maybe I've got a gripe, because this serves by way of my introduction to Mike. I had literary aspirations. I always wanted to continue my reading, but I'm one of those guys of whom Bacon said that married men do anything for money. Let's call it a family man, and I found myself always doing anything for money. That's right, just one of the family, because they all did things for money. But one time, from my youth, I always had ambitions, was ambitious to become a crossing watchman on a railroad. You know, you're in a shanty, you have a little stove, and a train comes by once or twice a day, and you let down the gates or you hold the populace back, then you go back reading your book. See, this is the way I was going to branch out literary-wise. And I got a job. It's true, the railroad is owned by a classmate of mine, but I got the job on my own merit, and it was the Long Island Railroad. And I got a job as a crossing watchman, and it was on a line between Jamaica, New York, Jamaica, Long Island, New York, and Brooklyn. You know, and they put me up on a tire, and there was a tower, and there was some mechanism with great gates to crank. And the first hour I was there, 30 trains passed through, going and coming. Now 30, that means you have 2 minutes to get the average, to get the gates down. Don't drop them on that horse over there. You know, there were horses then too, or on the car, or on a pedestrian. Get them down before the train comes through and wipes up the populace, you see. And, I got no reading done. I heard of Hoboken as a joke in the vaudeville, but I was not a guy that was particularly, you know, addicted to blues and so on. But it turned out it was written by someone whom I'd known through all the writings of Floyd Dell early in the game, because I used to browse around. And that's how I got to know Mike. Now, I owe him, he's always been my shovel that I leaned on. Not like in the old capitalist WPA, you know, where you leaned on the shovel. But I certainly learned early in the game not only to get pay increases. They asked me, at a treasury, how much do you make on the Long Island Railroad? Oh, I said, I get $90 a month and a pass. I go anywhere on it. Well, they said, that averages about $20 a week. If you play a very wacky character, because you seem to be the type in this play, we'll give you $25. Well, he got me started on the road, you see, so that was a pay increase. End that part, that little chapter, and then I came west early, and I'm going to read something from Mike that he's written. He wrote it to me because I've been advertised in the papers reading, you know, something from Mike Gold's works. And I came to the West Coast, and lo and behold, in that period, there was the WPA Theater came into existence. I was not on the project, but I knew some of the people inside, and I'm the kind of a guy that can infiltrate or likes to infiltrate, you see. So there was a kind of a scheme. They said, this play was written by somebody you know, and it was this play on John Brown. You know, only in the figurative sense do I use that term shovel, that WPA figure, because, you know, this was a real job he did. This was real work we did. And then there was, he's also an excellent, I don't want to compare him to the Madison Square Gang, or the Madison Avenue Gang in New York, but you know that I did have a sort of an association with a group, with a firm known as Bay Region Publishers. They place with more movement. The contrast, let's say, was New Year's Eve when some of my friends, our mutual friends, came up here and looked around on New Year's Eve. There wasn't a single, shall we say, gemütlich party, you know, kind of public function to go to in Louisiana. And, you know, it's easy. Sometimes our best work is the result of a very sharp era, like in the 20s when Mike and Floyd Dell, I think it can be said, they carry the torch, you know, the radical torch on the literary field from the 20s until there were more to pick it up, you see, in that. And it was a great privilege to be associated with somebody who was deeply rooted in his times. And it's a... I didn't know, after that agreeable surprise meeting with you last year, that was when he was here on his 60th birthday anniversary, that, George, it is hot here. Do you remember our Dantean summer? That's Danton, you know, the French revolutionary leader who went through hell. This one feels like the worst. It has been around 94 up all week. 97 yesterday, probably 100 today. We are sweating it out under the roof of our Bronx apartment house. The cat is panting quietly on the tiled floor of the bathroom. My wife is sewing in a chorus girl costume. I'm typing in underwear. The poor old Jews in the old age home and chronic sick shelter that I can see out of my window look quieter than ever. Kids are yelling and fighting. It is hell to be poor in a New York summer. But I figured out the other day that I've spent at least 35 of them here. And how it was done, I cannot understand. But enough of that. I will break down and grab a bus for San Francisco, that beautiful city that God air-conditioned without the modern gadgets on conditioning, that on condition that it would never be a scab town. George, on a hot day like this today, I do wish I were settled in San Francisco again. I spent two of the happiest years of my youth working there, and almost feel as if I ought to go back. Maybe it will be possible.
Comrades and neighbors, I really feel very touched by the whole thing. I dreaded it coming here. Tell you the truth, it's like going to a dentist, you know. And I've had at least 104 such birthdays. Every time one of the papers got into trouble, they'd give me a birthday card. This is the latest. I'm sort of a veteran of it. Well, you know, when you hear all these things, nobody's as good as that. Well, nobody can be as good as that. So you get feeling more and more inferior and ashamed. Terrible feeling, I tell you. It's hell on wheels. But I really loved everything tonight. I think it was really wonderful. And I liked the way they arranged some of these writings, put them together, a sort of a montage. It was not an easy thing to do, and I knew that somebody had worked at it with real thought and affection, and I'm really grateful to all the actors and writers and spent in a good cause. And, very active on the raising money for the worker in New York, has been, and he's an old timer. He really goes as far back that he was a man with money who was a socialist since he could fly a kite, I think. And he's about 76 now, still going strong. But he told me about a millionaire friend of his who said to him, Julius, he says, if you reach the age of 60 and you have one friend, you are a success. And I've always thought about that remark. I look around here and though I only gave a dollar bill to the paper, I feel like success. Planchet, one of the things some of us who are a little older, I think will confirm me in this fact, it may be the pathetic illusion of years. We always think that it was a lot better in the past. Life was more...